Hello and welcome to the program. Ah, yes. The poor old wolf has had a pretty bad press in popular culture from as far back as we can imagine. In the 6th century, the big bad wolf was immortalized in Aesop's Fables, long before Disney got his commercial hands on it, in The Three Little Pigs.
Who's there?
I'm a poor little sheep, with no place to sleep. Please open the door and let me in.
Not for the hair of our chinny chin chin. You can't fool us with that old sheepskin.
I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in.
The story of Little Red.
Ooh, Grandma.
Riding Hood.
What a big mouth you've got.
Dates back to the 10th century. And the phenomenon of humans shape-shifting into wolves at full moon has in recent decades spawned a whole new TV and film genre for a whole new generation. Wolves have suffered from centuries of demonization. So talk of reintroduction and boosting their populations is inevitably met with resistance, with opponents particularly worried about the threat to livestock. At this point, their presence has been re-established across most countries in Europe. And with recent calls for wolves to be reintroduced into Ireland, almost 250 years after the species became extinct here, today, Mooney Goes Wild looks at the grey wolf. Wolves are a keystone species, which means that they have both a direct and indirect impact on keeping the ecosystem together. They influence their prey. Their prey influences the plant and animal species beneath them, and so on down the chain. Wolves can turn grassland into forest and create habitats that hundreds of species can use by keeping deer on the move so that they can't overgraze fragile plants like tree seedlings. Last year, independent TD and now member of the European Parliament, Mick Wallace, called for wolves to be reintroduced to Ireland. His reason was that it would be a cost-effective addition to the bovine tuberculosis eradication programme. Later, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan also called for their reintroduction. Pádraig Fógarty is an ecologist, environmental scientist and campaign officer for the Irish Wildlife Trust. He's also former editor of Irish Wildlife and is author of Whittled Away, Ireland's Vanishing Nature. Pádraig is a leading advocate to bring back the wolf to Ireland.
That would be the most wonderful thing for Ireland. What an incredible vision that would be. And it's not just wolves, you know, it's bringing back the wild forests. It's bringing back all the other plants and animals that we've lost over the years. It's restoring our natural ecosystem. I think it's an incredibly hopeful vision. And I think it's something that people are crying out for these days with all the bad news. We think we really need a hopeful vision.
Who's crying out for it?
I think we're extraordinarily nature deprived in Ireland. I find if you want to go and experience wild nature in Ireland, where do you go? There aren't that many places. And I think people, sometimes they don't even know they miss it, but I think they do miss it. And I think when you talk about wolves, there does trigger something in people. It is emblematic of wild nature. And I think people long for that connection. And that's why I think it's so important to talk about wolves.
But it's not emblematic of Irish wild fauna, I don't believe.
Wolves? Well, wolves.
I know they were here, but are you telling me that when people think of nature in Ireland, they think about wolves? I disagree.
Well, what we have today is like a shadow of nature. We've lost so much over the years. The danger is that people look out their window when they're driving on the motorway and think, this is normal, this is how nature looks. It's not. And I think that's what we really have to challenge. Now, I mean, I could be talking about bringing back cranes or bitterns or some of these mosses that have disappeared over the years, and they'd all be perfectly valid as well. The difference is that doesn't trigger people in the way that wolves does, and I think that's why talking about wolves is so valuable. Of course, from an ecological point of view, wolves animals play an absolutely vital role in healthy ecosystems. So if we are going to be serious about restoring healthy ecosystems to Ireland, we have to be talking about big predators.
I think you're right, because if you take the name Moktira, you know, and that is that has a resonance here, because the Moktira, of course, was the outcast, the outlaw, the son of the countryside, whom nobody wanted, sort of thing, and Robin Hood type thing. Well, he wasn't really Robin Hood, because he wasn't doing much good. Robin Hood was. So it kind of resonates with our mindset here in many ways. We like to be rogues. So I agree with you entirely that the wolf is very much part of us. Way back.
Yes, I mean, and you can look at maps from the Ordnance Survey and you'll see place names associated with wolves. You'll see place names associated with wild boar. Of course, Tork, like Tork Mountain in Kerry, is associated with the wild boar. You'll see place names like Eagle Rock all over the place. And these are the shadows. They're like the little footprints that are left behind of the nature that used to be here. And it hasn't completely disappeared. It's almost like a phantom limb in a way that I think when you do talk about restoring nature, it is exciting and it should be exciting. There are over 2,000 wolves in Spain. There are thousands of wolves in Italy and Romania and places like this. There are even wolves in Belgium. And, you know, so one of the things I hear a lot is that, oh, Ireland isn't wild enough to have wolves. We don't have enormous forests. Wolves don't need forests. They're very, very adaptable dogs is what they are at the end of the day. And they're absolute survivors. I mean, when you look at the amount of effort that has gone into trying to wipe them out completely, and yet they've hung on and they've come back. It's an extraordinary story. I think they deserve our respect.
But you'd have to pick a place to introduce them in the first place if you did. So where would that be?
This is an important question. And I suppose we'd have to then ask, you know, technical questions about is there enough for them to eat, and, you know, and ultimately will people accept them? There are areas in Ireland where that could be suitable. Maybe not today, but at some point in the future. So, and I would bring this back to, let's say, if we are serious about tackling climate change through nature-based solutions, then we're talking about bringing back big areas of native woodland. If we're talking about bringing back big areas of native woodland and we want that to function properly, then the wolf, we see where wolves fit in, along with lots of other animals, of course. And then you look at places like the Wicklow Mountains, for instance. The Wicklow Mountains is the largest upland area in Ireland. It's in an awful state at the moment, but it could be amazing. It could be the biggest wild forest in Ireland, which I think would be a great thing for people as well as the wildlife.
And have you spoken to the National Parks and Wildlife Service about this concept of perhaps bringing back wolves and putting them in the Wicklow Mountains?
Well, now, we did get a reaction from the minister. Well, it was to Eamon Ryan's suggestion we bring back wolves. The minister dismissed it out of hand. But we know, I mean, we're failing on so many fronts protecting nature. We can't protect our curlews and our bees at the moment. So I think an awful lot has to change. The wolf is just one part of that.
Do you think we're disconnected from nature here in Ireland?
We are totally disconnected with nature in Ireland, and this is one of the, it's almost the heart of the problem. People say, you know, why would you bring back wolves? The first thing that will happen is that they're shot or poisoned. And they're right. And why is that? That's because our relationship with nature is entirely dysfunctional at the moment. We don't see where we fit in nature as human beings. And that is at the heart of our total global ecological collapse. So we have to address that. And what I mean by that is that we have to ask ourselves some pretty fundamental ethical questions, such as, does non-human life have a right to exist? Do other plants and animals have a right to exist and to evolve? Now, other countries have tackled this and they've put these rights of nature into their constitution. I think that's something we should be looking at.
Now, the Scottish argument for introducing wolves is that they would change the ecosystem. For instance, the maximum density of deer is about 10 per square kilometre. In some parts of Scotland, it's 20 deer per square kilometre. So you need, and they have to go out and shoot deer to keep the thing down, which is a very, very awful thing to be have to do, you know. So if they bring in wolves, the wolves, it is hoped, will clear these, and all kinds of plants and shrubs that never got a chance will start coming up now, because the ecosystem is like Yellowstone. The ecosystem was transformed with the arrival of wolves. It was realised that wolves were crucial to a proper and developed ecosystem there, and the same would happen in Scotland if they introduced them. Now, in Ireland, we haven't got the deer pressure. We do have some deer pressure. But go forward 10 or 20 years after our introduction, and what would you see there as a result of the wolves, which you can't see today?
In a way, I'm reluctant to make predictions because nature is very unpredictable. We don't really know what happens. And in one way, you can argue, yes, we need to bring in wolves in order to control the deer, and that makes sense. But, you know, would it actually happen in reality? We don't know. And it's also a very utilitarian argument. You know, I'm not really saying I want wolves back so we can control deer. I want wolves back because it's, you know, an integral part of our heritage. I know in Scotland, I went to visit the Glenfeshie estate in Scotland last summer, where they took the deer out of the valley completely. And the forest is just coming back all on its own. Mm-hmm. It's like the forest is almost like lifting up out of the ground. It's an amazing
But is it
sight.
Not missing the deer?
But the reason that that's happening is because they have got rid of the deer.
No, I know, yeah, but yeah. They're now missing from the landscape,
yeah,
is what I'm saying.
So exactly. So that's not really sustainable. It's almost like an emergency measure. But it shows, and in Ireland we do have, I mean, you go to the west of Ireland, whole valleys barely have a shrub sticking out of them. And that's because of deer in some places, sheep, goats. The trees are not being given a chance to grow. And to me, it shows nature is almost, it's like waiting, it's biding its time, and it'll spring back if we just give it a chance. Ultimately, all of this comes down not to the science or the ecological practicability. It comes down to our own attitudes. Can we live in the countryside with wolves? I mean, we saw the last year or two, France has been introducing bears. And they had it all perfectly worked out in terms of the number of bears they thought they needed to reintroduce a viable population in the Pyrenees. What they didn't account for was the enormous opposition they would face from the farming community in the Pyrenees and the sheep herders. And of course, a few weeks ago, Emmanuel Macron decided they were stopping the reintroduction programme to appease the farmers. And so if that project fails, which would be disastrous, I think, for the Pyrenees region, it won't have failed because of scientists' calculations. It'll have failed because of the lack of societal acceptance.
I want to ask you about the prison camp approach to this. If you were to enclose a large area with a large fence and so on, and brought in wolves within it, how big would it need to be for a viable introduction? That's keeping out all cattle, sheep and the odd people. People could go into it all right, but how big would that have to be? Or is that a viable thing? It was suggested in Scotland and there was all kinds of protests and things, but could we do that? And where would we do it? And how big would it be?
It's not an approach I'd be in favour of. I think the idea of fences around national parks is part of our problem. In fact, it might sound paradoxical, but I think national parks are part of our problem because we have grown up in the last 30, 40 years saying, OK, national parks, that's where nature goes. We put nature into the parks and that's where it stays. And everything outside the national park, that's not nature. That's, you know, human environment. Of course, there is no distinction. We are nature. And if you put a wolf in the Wicklow Mountains, it's all very well to say that, you know, we've got enough space in the Wicklow Mountains. If that wolf decides, I don't like it here, it'll be gone. And the next week it'll turn up in Mayo or Cork or Belfast or something like that. So it wouldn't be like any other type of introduction we've done before. And that's why to get to the root of that and to get to the heart of our acceptance of nature. This is not a conversation that would have to only happen within one community in, let's say, the Wicklow area. This is a national conversation we have to have. And actually, that's not as far-fetched as it sounds, because the government, the Dáil, has voted on holding a citizens' assembly on the biodiversity emergency, which I think is a really great idea. They just haven't done it yet.
Folklore will come to the rescue, I think, and history of wolves should come to the... We have to change hearts and minds, as always in this game, is to get around the public to change their outlook. And
I totally agree with you. We have grown up with stories about nature being nasty and bad and the wild forest being dark and full of malign forces. So, yeah, I agree. We need to go back to those stories.
Do you think it will happen?
Yes, I do.
When? Put a time frame on it.
I think we'd be talking 10, 20 years. And this is, again, one of the problems with the debate as we've had it so far, is that people will say, oh, Ireland is totally unsuitable for wolves right now. And they're right. It is totally unsuitable for wolves right now. But if we want Ireland to be suitable for wolves in 15, 20 years' time, we have to start talking about it now and we have to start preparing for it.
We can live side by side with wolves successfully, I believe.
Oh, yes, we can. And the transformation that has to occur is within ourselves. But we do also have to transform the countryside as well.
Horrig, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
There's also talk of reintroducing wolves into the wild in the UK. If that happens, it's likely to be in northern Scotland. And it's unlikely to occur for some years to come.
Now, it may surprise you to hear that we already have some wolves enjoying life outside of a zoo environment here in Ireland. Recently, a Donegal solicitor and zoologist realised his childhood dream when he brought three wolves into the new Wild Ireland Wildlife Sanctuary in Burnfoot, near the Donegal border with Derry. He also brought in three bears, a lynx and some monkeys. Apart from the monkeys, the animals were all once native to Ireland, and they've joined the wild boar and deer who set up residence at the sanctuary previously. Terry Flanagan went to check it out.
That's an incredible sound, that, Killian.
Isn't it amazing? Especially on a misty morning like this in the hills of Donegal, to hear the wolves howling again here for the first time in 300 years.
Oh, I can see them. I can see them. Three of them there. They're fantastic. They're much bigger than I thought they'd be.
Bear in mind, Terry, that these guys are only 6 months old, so they're big, big animals, and they're going to get a lot bigger.
Now, Killian McLaughlin, you are a biologist and you're a solicitor.
Yes.
And you've started a sanctuary up here in County Donegal, Wild Ireland. Tell me a little bit about it. Tell me what it is here, what we're looking at.
Okay, so this all started in my back garden when I was a young lad. I used to rescue crows and hedgehogs and all sorts of animals, and very often animals couldn't be released back into the wild, so in my back garden is where they stayed. Eventually the back garden became too small, and I always had the ambition of purchasing a large plot of land and developing a wildlife sanctuary. So from there, the concept of Wild Ireland really evolved. I always noticed that when people used to come and visit my little sanctuary in the back garden, that they were fascinated by the wild animals, particularly the native wild animals.
But that's what you would have had then.
Yes.
Looking in here now at these wolves and listening to them.
Sure.
They're not native animals, or certainly not now.
Not now, Terry, but they were native here at one time. In fact, wolves were so common in Ireland that Ireland was once nicknamed Wolfland.
But how long is it since the last wolf was here in Ireland?
The last wolf was killed in Ireland in 1786 in County Carlow.
Right.
By a pack of Irish wolfhounds. It was hunted down from Mount Leinster and killed by the pack of wolves, which is pretty incredible. That's not that long ago when you think about it. The last wolf in Ulster, I believe, was killed about 20 years before that near Belfast. And the
so they would have been fairly common in Ireland at that time.
They were,
that time.
Yes, they were very common in Ireland. In fact, when Oliver Cromwell put the price on their heads, there was up to 1,000 wolf pelts being exported out of Ireland every year. Wolf pelts for the fashion industry or whatever they used them for back then. It was Cromwell, when he came to Ireland, he put the nail in the coffin for the wolf. He put a price on their heads. He put £5 on a male wolf and £6 on a female wolf's head. And then you had these professional wolf hunters coming into Ireland to make a living. That was a lot of money back in the 1600s.
So I'm sorry if you cut across. I'm just looking at that one there, that big one. It's licking the other one on the head as they're howling.
Yes, that
Explain
is a socialisation. So wolves, as we all know, howl. There are several reasons why wolves howl. This, what you're seeing in front of you now, is socialisation. I always compare it to us having a sing-song on a night out or whatever. You know, it's a way of socialising. The second reason that wolves howl is to mark their territory. So when they're howling, they're telling all the wolves in the area, this is our territory, keep out. And the third reason that wolves howl is when they get lost. So if a wolf has become separated from their family, they will start howling, and then the family will hear them. Sound travels very well through the forest, and then they can locate their family by shouting, I'm over here, where are you? And they respond, and he can find his way back to his family. So that's the three reasons that they howl.
Now, you have three wolves here. You have them in a really nice enclosure, a lovely pen there for them. There's no way they can get out. Are you sure?
Well, how do you answer that one? All of our fences are built to a certain spec, and we have to meet certain standards. When I was designing this, I took advice from experts in the field, and they advised me on how to design a wolf fence.
Tell us a little bit about these three here, then.
Okay, so we have three wolves here at Wild Ireland. We have two grey wolves, Oisin on the left, Fergus on the right. Mm-hmm. They're European wolves. They're the same species of wolf that was once native to Ireland. And then on the right, then we have Finn. Now, Finn is a little bit of a...
He's much brighter, isn't he?
He is.
Whiter.
Yes. He's a timber wolf from North America. So he has Arctic wolf blood in him, and that's where he takes his colour from. And the timber wolves would get a little bit bigger than the European wolves. Now, they're all grey wolves. The grey wolf was once very, very common, found right across the Northern Hemisphere, all the way from Ireland, heading east right across Russia, Siberia, Alaska, Canada, North America, right down as far south as Mexico City. They were also found quite far south in Europe and into North Africa as well. They've met the same fate right across the range as the Irish wolves did. They've been hunted, persecuted and lost their habitat, and wolves are now just living in little fragmented populations around the world. They're nowhere near as common as they used to be.
Would you like to see wolves reintroduced to Ireland again in the wild?
Personally, I would love to see wolves back in Ireland. However, I don't believe that it would be possible the way things are at the moment.
But surely people would be afraid of them. I mean, I'm looking in at these now, and they're big animals. They're bigger than the biggest Alsatian I've seen.
Correct, and they're going to get bigger.
How much bigger?
Probably twice the size, Terry, to be honest. They are a lot stronger, a lot more solid than a dog. Wolves are, of course, the wild ancestor of the domestic dog.
Yeah, but they're carnivores.
Correct.
And if they're carnivores, they may attack humans.
It's very rare that a healthy wolf would attack a human. Very rare. Now, in saying that, I couldn't believe, when I said I was bringing back wolves to Ireland, I couldn't believe the attitude still existed here, you know, that we can't bring these animals. You can't do this. What about the sheep? What about the farmers? What about this? What about that? And I'm keeping them in an enclosed area here. They're not getting near sheep, but that attitude still exists. And that attitude was coming from people that I can guarantee you sit at home and they watch the wildlife documentaries and they learn about them shooting their lions and leopards in Africa or their tigers in India. And that's terrible. They shouldn't be doing that. They should be protecting their animals. But if I was the African farmers or the Indian farmers, I'd be turning around and saying, well, you know, you guys killed off all your predators. You killed off your wolves. You killed off your lynx. You killed off your bears to protect your livestock. And now you're pointing the finger at us. Mm-hmm. That attitude has to change first.
I'm just looking at them here behind us now. They've stopped howling and they're actually playing.
Yes, they're very playful. You have to remember they're only big cubs or big puppies, and they act very like pups. And yeah, they do, they play, they run around. You can see we've made this habitat for them as big as we can. They've got natural trees and caves, and we've got a pond for them to swim in. And yeah, they spend most of the day playing, Terry. They're very happy wolves. Look.
Oh yeah, look at that, chasing. They're actually playing chasing around there.
There's
the third one joining in now as well.
Yes.
They're very fit animals too, aren't they?
They are incredibly fit. Yeah, we exercise them as much as we can as well.
Do you get into the pen with them?
I do, Terry, because I've raised these three from little cubs. I will continually assess that. At the moment, they're only 6 months old and they like to socialise with me only. If strangers go in there, they disappear. They do not like strangers. The myth of the big bad wolf is exactly that. It is just a myth. And the Irish people respected and revered the wolf. They called him MacTyr, the son of the land or the son of the country.
Tell us a little bit about these three, where you got them from.
The wolves that we have here were born in a zoo. Fergus and Oisin's mother had four cubs outside under a bush. She was only looking after one of them and the other three were left out in the cold and the wet. So the people in the zoo were able, in the wild they would have just died of course, but because they were in captivity, the keepers that looked after them were able to put them onto a bottle and save them. And then Finn's mum had 11 pups and she wasn't able to look after 11, obviously, so they took some of them and raised them on a bottle. So in the wild, the weak ones would have died off and only the strongest ones would have survived. But because they were born in captivity, they were able to be reared artificially on a bottle. So I put the pack together when they were very young. I raised them in the house with our dogs. And as a consequence of that, I have a very close relationship with the wolves. There is a presumption when you see them that they're going to be quite dog-like. Nothing could be further from the truth. Wolves do not look for praise, or they don't try to please you at all. They want you to please them, unlike a dog, which is the other way around. The howling fascinated me, Terry. When I used to leave them as pups, they would howl to communicate with me.
Do you howl back at them?
I do howl with the wolves sometimes. We don't encourage other people that visit Wild Ireland to do that. Howling at the wolves, in their mind, they believe then that there are other wolves in the forest here.
Mm-hmm. It confuses them and upsets them.
They howl back and they say, no, this is our forest, keep out. If humans continue to howl at the wolves, they move away. They think, oh, these guys mean business, we're going to get out of here. And they move away. So we ask people to respect our forest and respect the wolves. And incredibly, since we've opened, Terry, people haven't been howling at the wolves. We haven't even had to pick up litter in this place, believe it or not. People really respect the forest when they come in here to see the wildlife and the beautiful Celtic rainforest or temperate rainforest that we're standing in at the moment.
How long will they live for?
They can live for the same length of time as a dog. So you're looking at into their teens, 12 to 15 years. Possibly a little bit longer in captivity. They'll live a lot longer than they would do in the wild because they get veterinary care and a good diet and stuff like that in captivity.
And would you hope to breed them?
No, this is an all-male bachelor group of wolves. That's fine. You know, wolves do live in bachelor packs in the wild. We're a sanctuary, first and foremost. We like to take in animals that have nowhere else to go. So if we started to breed animals here at Wild Ireland, then we would have to look for homes because eventually we would end up with too many. Thankfully, our wolves are very healthy. We give them a very complete diet, Terry.
I'm just looking here. You've got some quail, isn't it? Oh, I see. Look at them perking up immediately.
Yeah, they see it and smell it. They were sitting looking. With their, they were salivating there. So I try and give them just one each for now. That's Finn. That's Oisin. Fergus!
Where is he? Where is Fergus? He's,
oh, here he is. You know, they all know their names as well, incredibly.
Oh, watch this. There's the water.
A lot of people are blown away by the fact that these animals were once native here. I get asked all the time, why aren't we taught about these animals in school? People get emotional even when they come here that they didn't know that these animals were native to Ireland at one time. And to come into this forest, I mean, even to walk in the forest without the animals is a beautiful experience. And people do respect the forest when they come in here. And the most important message, Terry, that I think people take away from this place is these are the animals that we lost and they're not coming back. Yeah. We need to preserve the little wilderness that we have left. Our forest is precious. It's our treasure. I don't think the wolves will be back in my lifetime. Let's preserve what the little wilderness that we do have left. Let's treasure it.
Grey wolves once roamed throughout Europe, but by the early 1900s, they'd almost been hunted into extinction. Now, after decades of protection, the grey wolf is making a comeback. But its return to the wild is by no means universally welcome, with farmers leading the opposition. Man's relationship with the wolf remains complex, and the approach of most European nations seems aimed at achieving a balance between conservation and control. Europe has about 12,000 wolves in around 28 countries. In places like Italy, the species is afforded full protection by the state, and in Portugal, compensation is paid to farmers for livestock damage. Although they have some protection, Spain's 3,000 wolves are considered a game species, while France's rapidly growing population is subject to culls for the protection of farm animals. Although they are listed as an endangered species, and killing them is illegal. Wherever you find wolves, you'll also find controversy. In 1983, it was established that wolves had made their way from Finland and Russia and were back breeding in Norway. Helge Sufterland is a broadcast journalist and wildlife expert. Helge, how are you today?
Hello, guys. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
What's the status of wolves in Norway? Are they endangered, Helge?
Yes, they are. They are on the famous red list, and they've been there for quite some years. After all, they were almost going extinct back in the 60s. And even in the early 80s, we only had three mothers who are ancestors to all the modern wolves that we have in Norway today. And last year, they tracked around 80 to 100 wolves in the Norwegian reviers or habitats on the Norwegian side of things. We share, of course, the Scandinavian population of wolves with the Swedes, and they have about 300 or so in their forests. So we're looking at somewhere around 380 to 400. And just going back 4 or 5 years, we had nearly 500. So something is happening.
But what is the problem? Why do people want to cull them? I mean, there's one thing that the numbers are increasing, but that doesn't mean you should necessarily organize culls to get rid of them.
You do have the odd stray wolf that goes roaming for sheep and other livestock, and that is naturally a problem. The thing about wolves are they are magnificent animals, but not terribly good map readers. And in Norway, at least, we have wolf zones, and that's just a line on the map. And if you stick on the right side of the line, you're good to go. If you move out from the wolf zone into the not wolf zone, you are in trouble and you risk getting shot. So how do you make this work in practical terms? I don't really know. I don't have the solution to it. It might be a technical solution in the future. After all, we have livestock now that can be held in place with virtual fences where they have a GPS locator around their neck who give them electrical impulses if they stray off. Perhaps you could see something like that with the wolf in the future as well. But as it is today, you have a very, very polarized debate where people either want to kill all the wolves or they want to have wolves in every part of the country. And that doesn't go together.
I'm thinking that would be some catch and tag
project you'd have to undertake there. You'd have to catch every wolf that's roaming free, regardless of where it's roaming. You'd also have to catch the ones in Sweden, by the sounds of it, and tag them and put GPS on them in order to give them a little electric shock as well. That's impossible to do that. It has to be.
I think that's far-fetched, yes. But after all, today we have a policy where the government want to track all the wolves pretty much anyway. So many of them get marked and GPS tagged for research purposes. But to do it with the whole population would be, of course, far into the future, I think. But if you look at the wolf, a male straying cub could probably wander 100, 200, 300 kilometers in a day. So, of course, and it's a natural thing for them to do. Mm-hmm. When they're too big to be staying around their parents, they wander off. And if they wander in the wrong direction, they will eventually be a problem, because they are a problem as soon as they're defined out of the wolf zone.
The other issue would be if you start tagging and putting GPS monitors on these wild animals, are they any longer wild?
Good point. And how wild can they be in an environment where we have put sort of invisible
controls
on them with roads and settlements and people wandering all around and livestock? And I mean, the thing is, back in the day, you had livestock in the mountains then as well, but you also had someone herding them. And having a human present next to a herd would fend off most of the wild animals. That being said, I had a friend who was a herder, a modern herder, and he had a lynx, and it brought down sheep in the middle of the night, not more than 10 meters away from him. You couldn't really herd yourself away from the problem anyway, I think. So it's very complex, and you have very strong opinions on each side. And I've tried in debates in my show to sort of get somewhere and get people to get to a common ground on this, and it's just not possible, I think.
Richard.
This is a social psychology problem. It's a socio-political problem. How is it that people are so blind? They are willing to spend vast sums of money on wolves when just to compensate the farmer for the odd sheep would be far cheaper. Now, you should give people tickets to Transylvania, because there they have wolves and they have 6,000 bears, and these bears kill several people every year in strange circumstances. Yet censuses in there and surveys there showed that the Transylvanians, the people in the Carpathians, tolerate the wolves, accept them, and tolerate the bears and accept them. They are not opposed. They don't want to kill them all. And they have a much greater problem than you ever had. Anyway, I'm saying things that you won't like me to be saying about the Norwegian public.
Well, I can totally understand you, because that point has been raised in the Norwegian debate as well. Why can't we do as they do down there on a very much less area? You have a huge population and you also have livestock. I think it's a thing that we have to consider here, and that is, we haven't had really wolves and other big predatory animals living next to us, sort of just beyond the walls of us, for 150 years almost. And that has probably done something with the psyche of the Norwegian, I think. So it isn't normal for us any longer to accept the fact that people doesn't get eaten by any big predator in Norway. It hasn't happened for many a year. It has happened in Sweden. A bear took down a hunter a couple of years back now. But you shouldn't really look at the sort of danger of being eaten by a wolf as a huge argument on the no to all wolves side, because that just doesn't happen. On the other hand, having your whole herd eaten by one stray wolf or bear does something to a farmer. And those stories, they resonate a lot in Norwegian media. So perhaps it is a little bit overplayed. The wolf came and ate 50 sheep, and perhaps it is a bit downplayed. No one has been killed for hundreds of years by any of these animals. So I don't know. And there's a whole NIMBY thing as well. Not in my backyard. Most Norwegians want wolf and bear to be where they don't live. How can you get around that one? I don't know.
The Norse Institute of Nature Research, which has an unpronounceable Norwegian name that I won't even attempt, they did a survey.
Even for us.
For you. A few years ago, they did a survey on this, I believe, and they came to the conclusion that there was no serious problem from wolves, that not to be worried at all, and that wolves are not a reservoir for rabies, which is the other sort of thing you hear, that wolves carry rabies and so on and so forth. Yet, the Norwegians didn't pay any heed to these scientists. Is that right?
You could argue both sides of that argument as well, because either way, when you bring science into this debate, people will have, much like with climate change, they will have something to come right back at you with and sort of discard whatever you bring from the scientific side of things. When it comes to rabies, we actually had a case of rabies in Norway. A young girl contracted rabies on a trip to the Far East. And she tragically lost her life. We also have the odd polar fox, Arctic fox, who contract rabies in Svalbard. But rabies, well, after all, the straying wolves that come and bring new genetics to the Norwegian packs, they do come from Russia or Finland. So people could argue, again, sort of going on a limb at least, that rabies is a danger in the extreme. But on the other side, we haven't had any cases being brought to the country from straying wolves for hundreds of years.
In the old days in France, children minded the flocks, and all they had was sticks to ward off a wolf that approached. All you needed was a stick. There was no danger whatever. There was a famous La Bête de Gévaudan, which is a place in the Cévennes, a famous wolf of this late 17th century, killed up to 30 people. Well, now,
yep.
Nobody knows what this notorious Bête de Gévaudan was, and the experts now conclude that it was probably an escaped hyena from the zoos that they had at that time, or else a young lion escaped from the menageries they had at that time. But that beast did enormous damage to the reputation of wolves in France.
What's the future for the wolf population in Norway, do you think, Helge?
I can't see any short-term solution to the conflict, at least, because there are so many people who want to get rid of any wolf anywhere in Norway, and there are so many people welcoming it everywhere in Norway. So I think we have to live with some kind of compromise in the sense of what we have today, where the government goes in every year and makes a count. They're tracking them on snow and they find DNA samples in scatter, and they make an educated guess on how many wolves we have, and they make a plan to license hunt so and so many to keep it on the population target, that is around pretty much 100 wolves and 3 to 6 litters of cubs every year in the Norwegian-Swedish border zone.
Helge, thank you very much indeed.
You are welcome. Anytime.
Biologists are often faced with the unenviable task of documenting the devastating effects of what happens when a species is removed from an ecosystem. But following the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone in the United States, they've had the opposite experience. Yellowstone National Park is situated mostly in Wyoming, but borders onto Montana and Idaho as well. Since reintroducing the gray wolf into the greater Yellowstone area in 1995, the resulting consequences for the ecosystem have continued to astonish observers. It's believed that the still unfolding cascade effect among animals and plants will take decades of research to understand. Wolf Nation, the life, death, and return of wild American wolves, tells the 300-year history of wild wolves in the United States. The earliest Americans revered them. Settlers exterminated them mercilessly. And now scientists, writers, and citizens are championing the fight to bring them back into the wild. The book's author, Brenda Peterson, is a passionate advocate for wolves and argues that without them, not only will the whole of the US ecology unravel, but it will lead to them losing much of their national soul. Brenda, can I begin by asking you, how did wolves become such threatening and feared figures in folklore and films like Little Red Riding Hood?
Well, I think mythology always reflects certain religious themes. And if you look in the Bible, you look at there is a fear of wild animals. When that was being written, we were a very minority species. We were not in control as we are now so often. So anything that threatened our survival, we were afraid of. And so we created stories. I mean, stories are what control everything. Stories, public opinion. That's why I am a storyteller telling stories about wolves. But when you look at the Puritans who came to this country, they came with a European sense that they were entitled. The Bible gave them that. Mythology supported that, the big bad wolf theory. And they came here and they thought, well, we should be in control and we will just kill any predator. They met with Native Americans who, in fact, had a very different worldview, a very sustainable and much more livable point of view. And the Native Americans saw the wolf as their brother and sister. There's a wonderful story that I tell called Who Will Speak for Wolf in Wolf Nation, where they actually talk about the fact that the wolf should not be killed. And if your village is encroaching upon the wolf territory, you should move the village. Now, that is a mature way of looking at other species.
Does the wolf's sinister persona in fiction partly explain contemporary society's fear of the wolf?
It's not just the past, mythology, religion, that has been a torment for wolves. It's the present. Disney is a main culprit. Disney, in that movie Frozen, has wolves that are going after children. And Disney also has perpetuated the myth of the wolf that will be evil and kill you. It's just this easy prejudice that continued because they're looking for a villain. I think there was just a recent movie called Grey in which wolves were attacking. It's a very simplistic way of looking at animals, but it continues. And when you add that to the prejudice of many people or some ranchers, then you have a prejudice that you have to fight. And as with any prejudice, like racism, it's really hard to change those people's minds and hearts, which is what we're trying to do with Mooney Goes Wild, with teaching kids to love nature, and with storytelling and science.
You are a passionate advocate for wolves.
Yes.
I believe that you were born on what you might call the other side of the tracks. You came from a family of hunters. Now, is it true that you did? And how did you manage to make the transition then to conservation? And finally, how does it inform your work now?
That's a very good question. Because I come from a family of hunters and in fact still eat bison and every now and then venison, and my father still hunts even though he's 92, I grew up on the forest lookout station, the U.S. Forest Service, and there were no wolves. And my father, because he was in the Forest Service, understood nature and understood other animals. And he used to say, there is really no such thing as a big bad wolf. And he would teach me the natural history of wolves. And one day, he would say, maybe you'll hear a wolf howl on this forest of your birth. And you flash forward, you know, maybe, I don't know, 50 years, and the first wolf in California did return to my birthplace forest. And I want to say about hunters, they are not the enemy. Many hunters, like my father, actually want to have wolves back on the landscape because they are respectful of other top predators and they don't want our forest to become like ranches. They want the wildness. They want the ecosystem that's healthy and strong. And I wrote a Huffington Post that I think I sent you that is all about the hunters who have been writing me saying, we want wolves on the landscape.
Now, Brenda, there's a big division between those who oppose wolves and don't like having them around and those like yourself who love them. Are you suggesting that it's rather like the abortion issue, in that you have two rather entrenched positions? Why is it so polarized?
Part of it is generational fear. Part of it is that when you haven't had an animal, another top predator as an equal on the ecosystem, there's a lot of myths that come up. In fact, the fact is that wolves are terrified of us. Since 2000, only two people have been attacked by wolves. That's a long time. And wolves usually, if they sniff you, will run away. And rightly so, because we two-leggeds are very dangerous to wolves. But the polarization comes from people who aren't really looking at both sides. In many of my interviews, I've actually talked to ranchers who are working with sustainable crops, and they are much more open. When you deal with people who are closed-minded and who just basically repeat the fears of their past generations and the prejudices, there's really no winning. So you have to kind of find those people who are open to dialogue. And I'm hoping that Mooney Goes Wild will be some of those people.
Donald Trump and the Republicans want to water down the Endangered Species Act and take federal lands out of public ownership. What effect would this have on the wolf population?
It will have a terrible effect, a devastating effect. And we have been fighting diligently against this. So far, there are still some wolf protections here in my state, in northeastern Washington and in Oregon, and some in the Middle Lakes areas. But the fact is that this administration is hostile to wild animals. They are not scientifically based. They will basically follow the old generational prejudices of many, many years ago, and they are not looking at the science that shows that wolves balance and keep a healthy ecosystem. And Yellowstone has proved that.
There are some legendary wolves.
Yes.
Tell us about 06, and why did she capture so much attention?
06 is a whole chapter in my book, and many people have come from all around the world, including Ireland, to see 06. She was a very strong alpha female. She was nimble. She raised many generations. And I think she captured our imagination because she was very available to be seen. Now, you know that wolves are afraid of us. So a lot of people in Yellowstone, they wouldn't see wolves, but 06 would trot across a street in front of people. 06 would bring her entire pack out so that we could witness them, you know, from a distance with our telescopes, playing, hunting coyotes, running around the stream beds. We got to see her next generations. 06 was charismatic to the core. And I think that's why she was the world's most beloved wolf and the most famous wolf. So when she was killed, when she went outside of the protection of Yellowstone with her family and her mate to hunt, and she was gunned down because she had a radio frequency collar, and many, many people were trying to gun for her because they thought it would be a trophy if they killed her. And someone who remains unnamed killed her. And the New York Times said, we not only lost the world's most famous wolf, we lost all the opportunity that people had to witness her. And we lost all the chance we had of her next generations because they dispersed. After they lose the alpha female or the alpha male, the pack kind of falls apart. The teachers are gone, the adults are gone, the teenagers take over, and all sorts of havoc. You know, when teenagers take over, things are not very stable.
Wolves use what we might call vocal fingerprints. Cambridge University has done some work on howling repertoires. This is fascinating stuff.
Well, I have a wonderful chapter called Wolf Music. It is, I'm a singer. I was a musician younger on the clarinet. When I listen to wolves howl, you know, think about how many actual wolves or actual people have heard a wolf howl in the wild. It's an amazing experience. I have this chapter, Wolf Music, where I interview the French classical pianist, Hélène Grimaud, who is a wonderful wolf advocate and started the New York Conservation Center in upstate New York. And I interviewed her. It's on my website. And I said to her, why wolves? And she said, think about this. It's social glue. They aren't just howling to claim territory. They aren't just saying, I belong here, you don't. It's not that simple. They howl in community. They howl to make music together. And I said, well, what kind of music do you think do you think of when you hear them? And she said, Rachmaninoff. And I said, how would you describe the howling of wolves? And she said, endless longing. Endless longing. If you've ever heard a wolf howl, there's something so profoundly moving. And yes, there's grief in that howl. There's pleasure. There's community. The social glue that we might feel singing with each other around a campfire, that's what you have when wolves howl. And think about this. How many wild animals answer us back? They usually run away in terror, and they certainly don't let us know that they're there.
I've been reading about the Wood River Project in Idaho. Could this be a model for a nationwide coexistence?
So the Sheep River Project, in the Sheep Highway, they've trained ranchers to be able to work with their sheep on the highway and actually deter the wolf predation. And it's very inexpensive. It has been so successful that when I published this book, there had been hardly any loss of sheep. And people are celebrating this. And the person who is working with this has gone all over the world teaching. You know, maybe I can send her to Ireland. She is teaching people to be able to work with coexistence with wolves, which is the sustainable way to do it.
How many farm animals do wolves actually kill each year?
Very few. In my state, it'll be something like 3. And there's only 3 million cattle or something. When you think of all the cattle and the sheep on our landscapes, the fact that in our state, say in Washington state, there's 120 wolves. 120 wolves, millions of cattle, that's out of balance.
At the end of your book, Brenda, you quote Doug Smith, who is the Wolf Project leader in Yellowstone. He says, wolves are back because people want them. How important is public opinion?
You know, when I was in Alaska covering the Wolf Summit in 1993, I was listening to my father, who was the head and the director of international wildlife agencies, and he was saying, it really isn't so much the science, although that's important. It really isn't so much the politics. What really changes is public opinion. And public opinion is in favor all over the world. You know, in Europe, you have wolves returning, in France and Germany and Italy and Switzerland. I think that Britain and Holland and Ireland and Denmark are the only places where there are not wolves, where they've been extinct for, you know, centuries. I think that when you talk to people, whether they're in rural areas or urban areas, the idea of restoring a top predator who is our equal, not our competitor, our equal, is very redemptive. It gives you hope for our children, for our children's children. It makes us feel better about ourselves, that we're not so self-referential or selfish, that we only want to be the top predators, and it helps our ecosystem. When I was standing on a hill in 1995 in Yellowstone, covering the first wolves to return in 70 years, there were people from all over the world, and they were absolutely, it was like they were meeting rock stars when they were watching those wolves. And I have been back there. I have talked to people all over the country, all over the world about wolves. We are not alone here. We know when we can be met with a wolf howl or another top species that we have help in balancing the ecosystem. And I think intuitively, emotionally, scientifically, we've proven it. We are better for having wolves back.
And for more information, you can visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all of our contributors today, to researcher John Riley and producer Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye.